You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
Every time we talk, you're moving close. I don't want you to stop. I don't want you.
Blake Shelton here on a Tuesday morning, joined by a son of the great state of Connecticut, Paul Kennedy. General, first of all, good morning. Thanks for doing this.
Hey, good morning, Mac. Thanks for having me back.
No. We should have done this a while ago. I have a book in my head that's been kind of brewing for a while, and as you know, I have two sons that are Marine officers, and so as those boneheads embark on a career as infantry officers, you know, as a dad, you're like, well, what would I want my sons to know before they went to war? And then I just kind of thought about that, and I thought, you know what, I would love to write a book with my friends, and everybody can contribute. One idea, okay. If you were going to tell my sons, hey, this is one thing that you should know that I wish I would have known before I went to war, what would it be? And surprisingly, maybe not surprisingly, but we have some pretty interesting friends, guys we've known for a long time, smart, tough guys, and they all have combat experience now, and so it's not surprising to me. Some of the incredible things that they've said as we've kind of done this little segment. The depth surprises me at times, although I probably shouldn't be surprised at that. But it does. And it's turned out to be very cool. And it's talking about leadership in combat. And so I wanted to have you on, not to simply talk about one lesson, but you have had some pretty unique experiences as a leader in combat, and so I wanted to have you back on and talk about that, if that's all right.
Yeah, that's fine.
Okay, all right. Quick synopsis of your life: born and raised in Connecticut, right?
Yep.
All right, and the son of a military family, right?
Yeah, my dad was a World War II veteran, and his dad was a World War I veteran.
Okay, so Kennedy family steeped in military history. What was the highest rank attained in the Kennedy family?
My immediate lineage, probably. My grandfather was a chief petty officer in the Navy.
Okay, so you're...
My father was a corporal that landed at Normandy, and that definitely colors your perspective.
In a huge way. Those are the pictures you look at, right? Rolling down the hallway, you look up, and they're sitting there, and... And it's those pictures that you have in your head, and they define, they define what you hold in, I think for guys like us, what you hold in highest regard, those pictures, because that's how you grew up since you were a little shaver rolling around in North Bloomfield, Connecticut.
But to the point that it's so humbling to think about what the most junior leaders in an organization are asked to do without, they don't have a staff, they don't have as much experience, they don't have certain resources that you have at a higher level. And yet we ask these young corporals and sergeants to do things that are really tough. So with those pictures in mind, and I took over my battalion before we went back to Iraq, and I took down the pictures of all the old commanders out of the entryway to the battalion.
Wow.
And I put the pictures of the squad leaders up, whoever was the sitting squad leader. And the thought was that the battalion is only as good as the 27 rifle squad leaders that lead it. And it was a big deal. We made those guys big men. They came in on all a lot of discussions about how we would fight, and have them in on those discussions rather than being filtered through a bunch of other channels. So yeah, those pictures mean something. And pictures of my dad in France and Germany and World War II, my grandfather, you know, are kind of foremost in my mind.
it's interesting how those pictures that you grew up with affected you in such a way as to fundamentally change. Because I can remember standing in hallways staring at those pictures, trying to see whose ribbons, when they were all put on individually, were crooked in 1933. And they go back that far in some battalions. And you stand out there and you look at them. But certainly it communicated something very different when it's the squad leaders that run this battalion that are out there. Your career, Boston University, and then the Marine Corps, and then as an infantry officer. Describe your experience as a lieutenant. Good experience, bad experience. Did you cross paths with great officers when you were a lieutenant?
I had a great experience as a lieutenant in 3rd Battalion, 9th Marines, out on the West Coast. Future Commandant Jim Jones was my battalion commander. Tom Sheets was the XO. I had a solid company commander, and they just stressed, you know, the basics. And it doesn't seem sexy at the time, but those were the things that I reflected upon as battalion commander in Iraq 20-something years later. Those are foundational. Right. So it was exciting. It was fun. We trained, you know, during the week. You'd go to the field for, I say, Monday to Friday or whatever, Tuesday to Thursday. And then there was definitely a social sense of, you know, General Jones, Colonel Jones at the time, would insist upon kind of the social aspects of being a Marine, and drank a lot of beer and told a lot of BS stories about each other.
So it's interesting because not everybody has that experience as a lieutenant, you know, be they who they work for or a variety of other circumstances. Some people aren't. Mine wasn't so good. My battalion commander was brilliant, but I didn't have a whole lot of contact with him. And my company commanders were not. And so I was not overly impressed as a young guy, so kind of interesting. And then from there you go, you leave 3-9, you go to basic school.
Right.
And how did that affect you, and how did that shape you as an officer?
I think that's where I really learned how to be an infantry officer, was having to teach it.
Okay.
We went during that period, you and I and others that have stuck around the Marine Corps. It was kind of a golden age. I think I've said that before. And General Gray had inspired a lot of intellectualism in the Marine Corps, and believe it or not. And we did a lot of reading. We challenged each other, and you got better just by being around peers that were really good. And a lot of those guys didn't get to stay in the Marine Corps, but enough of them have, and it's carried them for, you know, into towards 30 years of service, because it was such a great experience. It's inspirational, so to speak.
You know what? And interesting. We were different too. We were, I think, as a group, it's kind of interesting. We were not afraid to speak our minds. Most of us were extremely sarcastic, but we read, and we started this thing called it the Mucus Society. But it was a Marine Corps University Society, and we wouldn't let anybody over the rank of captain show up, because they would always like, you don't know what you're talking about, blah, blah, blah. And we would present papers. We would gather at IOC, we would present papers, and then we would rip each other a new one, and we'd drink beer down there. But it was great for all of us. It was to write, to have your peers look at it and say, hey man, what do you mean by this? And I remember doing it with Dave Furness and just ripping him a new one just for drill. But how much fun it was. And, because we all enjoyed the intellectual part of our craft. And then you had guys like John Kelly and John Allen, rolling around there, and they made it fun in addition to, having big intellects. And it was one of the best tours, that when you talk to all the guys that have served there, and Kelly and Allen too, and they're, you know, hell, I mean, they help run the world these days, but, you know, they even say that, No. It separated me from my peer group. It made me different. It shaped me in terms of intellectually what I expected of myself and how I thought that the world ought to work. So it's I think really interesting. As you said,
Matt, remember with Kelly and Alan, they knew that we grew up in a tradition that kind of de-emphasized the intellectual part, and so they would throw a book out that they knew you would eat up. And they would follow up with a discussion. Hey, what'd you think of that? And then he says, well, how about reading this? And then it would lead to just a habit of devouring books and getting into the details of you know what took place, whether it was World War II or Vietnam. And we've kind of gotten away from that. And so you get a lot of veterans from the last 15 years coming back, and like, well, I really don't need to read that stuff because that's not what my experience was.
Really?
And I'm not going to, you know, what are they going to tell me? And so you go back to, you know, what can you learn from history? And, you know, you talk about sergeants and having to make decisions and the weight of responsibility. And I default to, you know, the Battle of Tarawa, where all the leaders are killed in the opening waves for certain units, and sergeants had to step up and become company commanders. And, you know, I mean, those are the things that I want to hear about. It's the decision making that took place, and there's a lot you can get from those other people's experiences in really high intensity combat. So.
No, it's like a little dagger in your heart when you hear somebody say that, because I think our experience was, the more you read, the more you had to read, because all of a sudden, and especially for those of us who never read a footnote in college, all of a sudden you start to read footnotes and you find, like, holy smokes, like, that's in Douglas Southall Freeman's papers and they're up in D.C. Well, I've got to go there and I need to get that. And we found, you know, I know I could just speak for myself. I found incredible stuff from the German troop leader manual that I think I destroyed a copier at IOC reproducing for everybody. Because we would go up and we'd make a copy of these things, and then we'd come back, and, you know, there was no electronic stuff, so we would make a copy for all of our friends. So, like, let's say there's 13 friends and a 200-page document. There were some serious trees dying for that, and maybe a printer or two, and we did that on a regular basis. And that's how we read. That's how we found. I also found a letter in the aftermath of the Civil War. There was great debates. The Southern Historical Society papers came up, and there was great writing about decisions in the war, and especially about Gettysburg. And one of the great letters that I found that was footnoted in Douglas Southall Freeman's Lee's Lieutenants was a letter from Lee's engineer, this guy named Captain S.R. Johnston, and he writes a letter to Lafayette McClaws, one of Lee's division commanders in Longstreet's Corps, about, you know, Gettysburg. He's writing this, you know, General Lee came and woke me on the morning of the second day as I slept near the fire, as was his custom. He told me to go to yonder, you know, small hill. And he recounts his ride up to Little Round Top and come back. He totally screws it up. He totally screws it up, and he paints for Lee a picture that isn't accurate. There's two more brigades that he doesn't see somehow. And so what to me the value of history and is when you had lieutenants, and a lot of them weren't interested in history, but we would go up and we would talk about decisions that got made at Gettysburg. And sitting on the battlefield, reading in the first and the second person, instead of they, you're reading I and he, it makes it come alive.
Sure.
And to hear lieutenants that say, you know, sir, I didn't really want to do this. I thought it was kind of stupid. We were just going to come and look at the battlefield, and you guys thought it was so much more. To hear that stuff makes you sit here and feel it. When you're sitting on the same train and looking at it, and Freeman McGilvery talking about the smoke, and McClaws talking about sticking his head through the tree line and getting it blasted from the peach orchard by two battalions of artillery, and he thinks he's rolling up on the flank like they did at Chancellorsville. And then watching them make decisions and try to unscrew it, just as strong Vincent does as up on Little Round Top. The dynamic nature of the battlefield, and I'll never forget, I wish I could remember a lieutenant who said it to me, sir, it's the same thing we deal with. And I said, exactly, the value of history.
So I had the opportunity, I got back from Iraq to take a group of, actually Afghanistan, take a group of sergeants that were getting out of the Marine Corps up to see those Civil War sites.
Right.
And we went up in about 6 or 7 10-passenger vans, and we just drove and started at Bull Run and Manassas and went up to Antietam. And really, you know, they're like, what are we doing this for? This has no bearing on what I just experienced in Iraq or Afghanistan. And it was like, when we start talking about decisions that were made and what you know at the time and why certain technologies that you started with were obsolete either very quickly or certainly by the end of the experience. And, you know, we were talking about smoothbore weapons and how they didn't get it. And one of the sergeants draws a conclusion, not a conclusion, but it draws a parallel to the use of IEDs. And we never saw the technology coming and the impact that it would have on our tactics. And so then it feeds on itself, right? So their contemporary experience, and you can always bounce it back to, you know, the setting that we're in. So we're at Manassas, or we're at Harper's Ferry, or we're at Antietam, and it brings it alive for them. And that was, it was really useful. And at the end of it, they said, "Sir, what are you trying to do? Get us to reenlist?" And I said, no, absolutely not. But I didn't want you to have, like, the only experiences that you had in the Marine Corps was deploying to the Middle East. And you didn't see a broader context and opportunities, really. I bet you a third of them reenlisted 2 weeks later. That, no shit. I got letters, I got emails, and they're saying, "Sir, hey, thanks for investing in us." We went and saw, I forced them to go to the, talk to their congressman. We went to the Capitol, and then they went to an evening parade at 8th and I, and we stayed at a hotel that they would never be able to afford. And it was like, it was an investment in kind of, making them realize that they are vested men. These squad leaders were important people.
Right.
In the places that they fought and the decisions that they made, and that there's a long, you know, 150 year link to those actions that you were just talking about at Gettysburg or Antietam or Chancellorsville, whatever.
Tarawa, right?
Yeah, it's the same.
It's the same. And then to me, when all of a sudden that little spark clicks and somebody says that, you're done. All right, now I can just get out of the way because they'll drive it from here. Interesting. My guest this morning, Major General Paul Kennedy, United States Marine Corps, head of Marine Corps Recruiting Command. How does your recruiting tours, what do you learn there that shapes you as a battalion commander?
Well, I'll tell you, this is independent duty, recruiting
right.
duty is,
right.
And they're far flung across the country. There's 1,500 sites, and it is a world dominated by staff non-commissioned officers, whether it's the professional recruiters or the ones that just come for 3 years and give their effort. And what you realize is that the military probably misses a lot of potential greatness and NCO development. And you don't see it until they get into these jobs where they're given the basic skills to succeed, and they're not allowed to fail, meaning we will not accept failure, and they do amazing things to accomplish their missions. And then they're colored by it for the rest of their careers. And when I was a battalion commander, I sought out my former recruiters because I knew that I could give them independent tasks, and maybe once in a while you give them a little amplifying guidance, and they succeed. And that's the nature of American NCOs. Like, they're way better than the amount of responsibility that we actually give them. They could shoulder way more. They could shoulder more education. They could shoulder more responsibility. Talk about the things you were describing. Really have in-depth discussions about tactics and decision-making and human nature and all that. We kind of lowball it. We don't challenge them enough.
Okay, so you learn that in your first recruiting tour?
Yeah. I mean, and then some of these guys, they come back to recruiting because they realize how good they had it, that they actually got to control their world. You're a staff non-commissioned officer in charge of a recruiting station up in Northern California, and you succeed, you basically dictate your schedule and all those things. And so that's kind of intoxicating that they get to control their lives like that. So why wouldn't you want to do that in an infantry battalion? And give them as much rope as they can handle and watch them take off. That led to that whole discussion about, you know, we wanted to create men of action. So if you read Russ Stolfi's book, A Bias for Action, how do you get NCOs that understand the commander's intent, mission tasking, how do they go forward and then complete a task, even though the conditions have changed, and maybe even the task you gave them was irrelevant at that point because things had changed, but they saw the bigger picture. Well, you got to grow that. And you got to give them as many experiences in peacetime to develop those habits, so when you go to a place like Ramadi or you go to a place like Sangin, that becomes second nature. And then you can really decentralize and drive tempo through that decentralization and succeed.
The my favorite quote in all of that, the senior commanders in the 7th Panzer Division allowed subordinate leaders to make mistakes. The tolerance of these leaders was never an excuse for slipshod performance. It was a calm recognition that rapid action in the face of uncertainty will result in errors, errors that can be overcome by more action. And to me, that's one of the things that the Marine Corps struggles with, that I think the Department of Defense struggles with. Hey, unscrew yourself, okay? Do you think you're going to be perfect out here? That's not the requirement. Okay, so you screwed it up. Unscrew yourself. You know,
right.
As General Zinni say, plaster the bastard with fire and then move on him. Do and get it right. You'll evolve it. So, you know, look, you got put here probably because your company commander made a mistake. You know, maybe your platoon commander didn't see something he should have seen. But, you know, you don't have any control of that. But the only thing you can do is evolve it and play it forward. And the human capital that we have, especially in the Marine Corps, we don't leverage, I completely agree with you, we don't leverage that enough. And when you hear this, the 7th Panzer Division, and you watch what they did in France and then what they did in Russia and the way they operated, it was a mature style of warfare because they had done it. They had lost their country because of it almost in World War I, and they had to come back and they had to do it better. And to me, it's very interesting to you know, not to be too much of a Germanophile. I don't say Wiedemeyer, I say Wiedemeyer, just for the record, okay? So don't say that on this program, right? Or you'll get your shit called out. Did you just say Wiedemeyer in my presence? But I love that kind of stuff. And it's
back,
on the backs of those guys that we do it.
Okay, so really the strength of the U.S. military is that core of NCOs. Nobody really does it the way we do it. And when we invaded in 2003, there were radio intercepts coming out of Nasiriyah. And one of the Iraqi brigade commanders that was facing Task Force Tarawa was complaining to his higher. He said, we don't understand what's happening, that as soon as we take these guys under fire, they break up into small teams led by their NCOs and basically – they just move on us. We can't stop that. Now, if what he was describing was they take them under fire and an officer has to give them directions and they move forward in a mass formation, you can deal with that. But when you're broken up into small teams and they're rushing forward under the direction of squad leaders and fire team leaders, that's impossible to resist. And I was like, man, that's exactly the secret sauce for American fighting. And then you see it both, you know, on subsequent tours to Iraq and Afghanistan. We're trying to overlay a culture of excellence of NCOs and their development and the decentralization that is impossible to achieve in certain other military cultures because they have no – there's no historic precedent for them.
You know, it's interesting because it's the same concept with, you know, you come home and say, well, can democracy work there? right? Look, they've never heard the two words Thomas Jefferson. They don't know that. Minority rights, majority rule, they don't know. They know the strong man, and if you're not part of his tribe, you better shut up and get in the corner, and because if you make a sound, he'll put a bullet in your head. And I think it's so foreign to Americans. They look at you like, are you serious? Like, yes! That's the way that a lot of the world lives. You know, the strong man runs it. Everybody else gets out of the way. You do what you're told. And so, you know, so relative to the military, what we have, I think, for Americans, it's interesting to hear when civilians listen to these conversations. They talk about, you guys talk about a world that I don't know about. And I think these things are all part of it. We take for granted what we, you know, the way we grow up, how we view America, how we view the world. And the rest of the country, the rest of the world doesn't view it like that. When I would go speak, I would talk about, I'd do this thing called the keys of life. And based on just my life experience, sorry, the murder of my two nephews, things that have happened to me in my life, you know, my experience in the Marine Corps. And so one of the things I talk about is when I say, well, first of all, why are you here this morning? And it's mostly, you know, younger people, high school students, college students, and whatnot. And so they'll I'll say, you know, in an attempt to get their attention, you know, what do I have to offer to you? And then I guarantee them, if you follow these four principles, you'll live a successful life. There's no doubt in my mind. And they are self-discipline, hard work, respect, and toughness. And toughness always kind of makes their eyes, you know, their eyebrows furl. And I said, you know, the world that's waiting for you out there, you know, if you don't make your car payments, they're coming for your car. You won't get to keep it. If you don't pay your rent, you're going to get evicted. Okay. And,
right.
And for all you women that are here today, you should thank God that you won the ovarian lottery to be born American. Because in probably 60% of the world, you're not at this school. You're not at this place. You're nowhere near here. And if
right.
anybody tells you that you can't be what you want to be, in the United States, punch them straight in the face. All right. Because they don't know what they're talking about. And so it is an interesting perspective, relative to whether we're talking about how to form a military, how to change a culture, and ultimately what we talk about in those discussions is how to win phase four, how to make it better in a sustained manner. But the American perspective, how do I say it tactfully? It's ignorant in the literal sense, and not there's no editorial significance attached to that word. It's simply they don't know, and it's interesting when they get to hear these kind of conversations about how different the rest of the world is.
And here's an indictment.
Uh-oh.
So the model that we use for socializing and training back, you know, 1942 was an anticipation of this mass mobilization of people just coming off the farm, you know, or coming out of the factory and putting a uniform on, and you had these, you know, one kid teaching 200 privates how to disassemble, you know, an M1, whatever.
Right.
We don't, that doesn't apply today. And we're still using similar techniques, of how we socialize and how we bring people on board and bring them part into our culture. And the quality of these volunteers ought to make you think that you can use a different methodology in bringing them on board. And just for your listeners, we, you know, all the mythology of how the Marine Corps recruited in the 60s and the 70s and even into the beginning of the 80s, it doesn't have any semblance of what we do today. And I don't take kids out of the court system. I don't take kids with felony waivers. I don't take kids that have, you know, childhood asthma or flat feet. All those things are disqualifiers. And the kids that I'm getting are actually of such a quality that they have choices. They could do something else with their lives. They don't need to join the Marine Corps. They made a decision to. And so knowing that, and you have these quality kids, squeaky clean kids, sometimes they're the top of their classes in these high schools, or their football captains, or whatever. What would you do with that raw material? How would you train that differently?
Wow.
And we really haven't done it. I mean, you go out to the basic school, you go to recruit training, you go to, you know, wherever. It looks very similar to what we were doing 30 years ago.
And I would tell you that even what we did, especially at the infantry officer course, we would have kids on a regular basis that roll through there from the Ivy League. And,
sure.
And you would have a book discussion, and they would take you on a journey. Well, you know what? It's interesting. In Dante's Inferno, and I was like, Dante's Inferno? What the hell?
Right.
Okay, look, let's not stray too far out of the lane, boys. Okay, let's keep this word. You know, but you have those guys, and they were the intellectual experience at IOC at the time was so atypical, and they loved it because, you know, I can recall one kid. I think his name is Brown. He was an Ivy League guy. He said, you know, sir, I never expected to be intellectually challenged like I've been intellectually challenged here, and I'm so fired up about it. Well, talk to me. Are we changing that? Are we looking at changing that?
I don't know. We talk a lot about it.
Can you change it in the Marine Corps? Because, you know, you mess with Paris Island recruit training. I mean, the walls get ready to come down.
So I was just down at Paris Island last week, Friday, for a graduation. And, you know, that process does work. When the parents come up to me, I was a parade reviewing official, and they talk about, you know, just in the limited contact they have had on Thursday and that graduation day on Friday, how the changes in their children. And one of my relatives graduated, and his father says it's almost like it's a different person. So, I mean, the process definitely is, you know, changes whatever person arrived. They go through a process. It's sustaining it and building on
right. The
foundation that Paris Island provides. And I'm not criticizing what we're doing. We just have a product that we could do more with because it's of a quality that speaks to that.
All right. I need to take about a 2-minute break. When we come back, I want to talk about your leadership experiences in Ramadi and then in Sangin, because you, by hook or crook, it's fate, really. You, by hook or crook, participate as a staff officer for General Mattis in the march up. But you go back as a battalion commander with 2nd Battalion, 4th Marines, and you, as hard as you lobbied to get to Fallujah, you're kicked to the curb in Ramadi. And then Thunderdome breaks out. Ramadi becomes really... And it will be that way for years, in a way Fallujah never was. It becomes this sore, this festering sore, where it is on, and they want to contest it for years. And you're really the first guy, and your Marines were the first Marines that fought in there. So I want to talk about that. And then you have, your deployment to Sangin. So I want to talk about your leadership lessons, because you led in two periods of high visibility, and we're very high in kinetics. So curious about your thoughts on that stuff.
Okay.
All right. We're going to take a quick break. Major General Paul Kennedy, head of Marine Corps Recruiting Command, joins us. We're talking leadership here on a Tuesday edition of All Marine Radio, right here on the All Warrior Radio Network. Don't touch that dial if you're smart. Thank you.
MilitaryByOwner.com is an excellent resource for any military family moving to a new area. We found a ton of homes to choose from and purchased a house 8 days later. This was the only site I used. Thanks, Military by Owner.
Are you PCSing? Do you need to find a home near a military base quickly? With over 45,000 listings and 15 years of experience helping military families find, sell, or rent their home near a military base, MilitaryByOwner.com can help. Military by Owner, proven and dependable.
My name is Juan Perez, Jr. I joined the military in 98. I commissioned as an officer. But I always had in mind the idea that I would go into the special operations community, particularly special forces. I was accepted to go into selection, and I attended on September 8th of 2001. As I was making my departure of the military, there was that uncertainty. What do I do next? How do I repurpose my skills in a way that's not only meaningful to me, but also that provides for my family and provides an increase in our a way of living, a quality of life. The Global South Foundation has resources when it comes to anything from building resumes to how to relate to a CEO in conversation, how to basically, again, repurpose that which I had learned in a career in special operations, dealing at the strategic and operational level, how do I take that and then turn it towards entrepreneurial spirit into business development, and how do I translate that so somebody can see that value? And in doing so, I landed a magnificent and very rewarding career. I'm the VP of operations for an IT company called BuildSource. What I say to veterans getting out, be bold. Be bold when you go to network. Go out to the Global South website, look at what events they have lined up, attend those events, you know, and participate. A lot of the events they hold, they're of key importance in this network. Go out there and engage, just like you would engage in a combat zone, you know, when you're networking there with folks that don't share necessarily your language, your culture, or your background, and yet we still make it happen. How can we not make it happen here?
The Global Soft Foundation is a great partner of All Marine Radio. Find out more about them at globalsoftfoundation.org/Marines.
I'm good, but I have a story, and I don't know where to start.
I'm good, but I feel alone in the crowd.
I'm good, but the past keeps coming back.
When the service member or veteran in your life says,
I'm good.
Are you really listening?
I'm good, but I can't get out of bed.
I'm good, but I can't sleep.
I'm good, but I feel overwhelmed.
I'm good, but I don't feel safe.
I'm good, but I still have nightmares.
I'm good, but I don't need any help.
I'm good, but I don't feel anything anymore.
I'm good, but I can't live like this anymore.
I'm really not so good. But are you ready to listen?
Suicide prevention is everyone's responsibility. Listen to the veteran or service member in your life. If you are in crisis or know someone who is, call the Veterans Crisis Line and Military Crisis Line at 1-800-273-8255. And press 1 for free 24/7 confidential support.
This is U.S. Navy and Marine Corps veteran Montel Williams. During my 22 years of military service, I had the honor of working beside many brave service women. They are the fastest growing population of veterans, and they can be a great asset to your company. Women veterans are trained to take initiative, adapt to change, and they're quick to learn. If you're an employer or a woman veteran, call the U.S. Department of Labor at 866-487-2365 or visit CareerOneStop.org.
You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. We continue. On a Tuesday, Mike McNamara with you, All Marine Radio. Privileged to be joined today by somebody who reported to my command at the basic school out at Combat Town a long time ago. And First Lieutenant Paul Kennedy showed up with his hands in his pocket.
Oh, God.
Driving a red Pathfinder with red duct tape over one of the taillights. Like, who is this guy?
I think it was actually translucent red, but it's okay.
It was translucent red, and so anyway, that was a long time ago. Talk to us about going to Ramadi. You obviously had the benefit of the march up and seeing things. You have had crossed paths with guys like John Kelly, Lou Caparata, Jody Osterman, who will become your peers as general officers, so they're going to have long, distinguished careers in the Marine Corps. I said Kelly and Allen. So you have, and then General Jones, you mentioned, you have a pretty good education getting you ready to go to Ramadi. Talk to us about getting there, and talk to us about what it was to lead in that environment. Because again, I mean, just here, in the last week, this last week, you guys. Remember Marines that were killed, and really when Ramadi exploded in April of 2004.
Yeah, so if just to sure. Caveat what I might say, and it goes harkens back to the folks that have influenced my career, my thinking. General Zinni used to talk, and Zinni had a lot of combat experience, right. Vietnam. He would say, "Hey, listen. I am not the burning bush on these subjects. I can only talk about what I saw in a specific place at a specific time."
Right.
and then you ought to speak to as many people as possible to draw your own conclusions. And you got to be careful about, a lot of my peers have gone on the road and they've figured it out based upon a 6-month deployment, or if they did a year as a colonel. And you don't figure it out. And it changes every year. And so I replaced a guy in Ramadi, from the Florida National Guard. And for what they were asked to do with the resources that they had and the conditions that were on the ground, it was probably valid. What the decisions he made were valid. But by February, when folks had realized that we were not going to negotiate with the old guard, and that a lot of officers that had retired in and around that region were now disenfranchised, and their pensions weren't even being paid, and we were not going to, look the other way, give them payouts, and let them stay in power, then they decided that they were going to register their displeasure by kicking off what we now know is the insurgency. So, really, it's so different than the march up that you can't even draw distinctions. And they weren't bad. The guys that we fought, really starting in March, but in earnest in April of 2004, had they been present during the march up, we would have had a hard time getting past Nasiriyah in the timeline that we actually executed. But these guys knew how to attack us in places where we were not as strong. I saw this again in Afghanistan, that they figure out what you don't want to do when you encounter a Marine rifle company or a battalion or even a platoon. You don't want to give them standoff. You don't want to let them use the supporting arms that really have a multiplying effect of, towards success. That stay in close and fight us with basically the same weapons. And that's kind of what happened, over the course of like 6 months. We were there for seven and a half months, but the fighting started in earnest about a month and a half in. And then it was game on. It was every day. It was a firefight in some part of the city. One of my company commanders from that period just was with me this morning. He had Fox Company out on the western edge of the city proper. And if you were to ask him what his experience was in the first 3 months, it would have been completely different than what it became in the second 3 months. And he eventually was grievously wounded by an RPG that landed in his midst. And so you develop your thinking over time, and really you need hindsight to tell you what really did you experience.
So what really did you experience?
There was a lot of probably misidentification of where the centers of gravity were and what was possible. What we had talked about in the first half hour or so of this broadcast of overlaying kind of American ideals on a culture that, hasn't been through the same history that we've been and have not arrived at the same conclusions that the Westerners have, and then you're trying to imbue them with your values. It's tough. Mostly they have to surrender what undergirds their system,
My job didn't allow me to see, I only had rare glimpses, and most of them, were with you. In fact, it's funny looking back, General Kennedy calls and he says, "Hey, you want to go AI with me tonight?" And I said, "What?" And he said, "Yeah, I've got this, I've got one of my company commanders, he's a first lieutenant, and he's now a colonel now. And he's a great guy." And he said, "Yeah, we're going to use lionesses for the first time, if you can, if Colonel Dunford will let you come out with me." So I got rare glimpses of it, but then General Kelly would drag me around the battlefield sometimes.
So your audience understands, when a general rides around the battlefield in a very conspicuous armored column, they tend to draw attention. And when Mike McNamara and then Brigadier General John Kelly showed up to the combat outpost, and within about 6 minutes, they started dropping 120 mortars on us. Do you remember that?
I remember. And we're running, right? The ground is leaping from the concussions. And
I'm standing behind a pillar that is just about the width of my narrow shoulders. We're running.
And he looks at me. And this is the fun
you
part.
You two were running, yes.
No, he was walking the line with Chris Bronzy. And you and I were walking, I don't know, 50 meters behind him. And all of a sudden you heard, and as we're running and the ground's concussing. And you're doing this with friends that you've known for a long time, which is great stuff. He yells at me, buddy, they're trying to kill Papa Jewel. You did, as we're running. And, you know, it's just this incredibly, the camaraderie that you have when you go through, you know, like we've known each other for, you know, since 1990. And with these kind of guys and that you've gone through a bunch of this is awesome. Awesome.
But Matt, that experience, not that particular experience, but those sorts of experiences where you're with people that you trust, and at that point we had taken a lot of casualties, and you know really that if you don't approach this with a little bit of black humor and, you know, really the things that breed camaraderie, needling each other, making fun of each other, believe it or not, like, that's what gets you through those bad situations. And one of my company commanders, Chris Bronzy, who's an incredible officer, former battalion commander now.
Right.
We'd be in the middle of a fight, and I would hear his voice, and he was always, you know, very calm, but you could sense the stress level. They'd be in the middle of a really bad situation down by the soccer stadium, and I would call him up just to bust his stones. And I would accuse him of, you know, all sorts of things, of being scared and hiding under somebody or whatever, until I got him to laugh.
You can hear Bronzy laugh on the other side of Ramadi, yeah, by the way. He's
right,
the loudest laugh. Oh, my God.
But that's what it took, it kind of takes the tension out of the room. And then you think better.
Right.
And so that's just, when you have that rapport, you have that relationship, and you are fighting with your friends, fighting alongside of your friends, and people that you trust. There's a lot that allows you to get through those situations, which is why, you know, a kid that served at Camp Fallujah or Camp Leatherneck in Afghanistan, that really was surrounded by people he didn't have that relationship with, and yet they're going out on convoys. I can see where in certain units they might have a higher incidence of post-traumatic stress.
Yeah.
Because they didn't have the support network to get them through those tough times.
Right. I had I'll finish. My point that I was going to make was one of the things you learned in Iraq was nothing is the way it appears. If you're seeing it, it's because they want you to see it like that.
Right.
And don't trust your eyeballs because they are incredibly good at watching you, at seeing your patterns, and then deceiving you based on what they've shown you. And, you know, you learn that hard lesson, and don't believe your eyeballs, okay? Don't believe your eyeballs. And so, you know, it's, I don't know, it's part of being experienced.
Do you remember Sergeant Major Jim Booker?
Course.
Who's very dark complected and grows a beard very easily. And so we did what we called bearded guy operations, where he took some Latino Marines that were also, you know, dark complected, and they all grew beards. And we put them in dish dashas, and they drove around an old taxi that we had, and they drove around the city. And they weren't discovered. And what they saw compared to what I saw in my Humvee with all my, you know, kit on is 180 out. Like we do not have a sense of what transpires when we're not on those streets. And so you're right. They show you the face that they want you to see.
And it's hard. I mean, that's why if and the lessons are this, it's hard. Don't expect to be right, you know, but if you don't have your head in the game, if you're not paying attention, somebody's going to pay. And most of the time, it's probably not you. And the moral obligation to have your head in the game, to study, to be serious about it, to be able to lead is to me, those lessons that you reinforce. You guys had some tough days in Ramadi, Paul. And that was new to you. I mean, how did you prepare yourself? How did you prepare yourself for, what was April 16th when you had how
April
many?
April 6th, yeah.
How many Marines did you get killed that day?
We had 12 killed on the 6th.
Okay.
And, you know, it was pretty traumatic. And I'm going to tell you that what you let in with is kind of a lesson that you got to have your head in the game every minute you're in that environment. And when I go back to operating bases in these large camps, and I see kids walking around with headphones on, and I see them walking around as though they're back in a rear area, you're in a combat zone. And you got to be listening for a mortar that's come whistling into your position, or somebody that doesn't look right that infiltrated your space, because we had those things happen. I put some kids out into an observation post, and they let their guard down, and they took some stuff with them that didn't lend itself to being alert and efficient, and they had headphones on, and all four of them were killed, and they were shot at point blank range, and they just kind of got lulled into, well, this is just another patrol to go to an observation post, and we're going to be back tonight, and we didn't have internet, but had we had internet, they would have probably forgotten about what they did for that day, and they were dead. And you realize that they were watched the entire time, probably for a week or a month. Every single eye in Ramadi was observing what these guys or their comrades were doing. And eventually, they're going to get you if you're not constantly vigilant. And so, I mean, I think that is the biggest lesson I've taken away from all of this, is that the enemy's trying just as hard as you're trying. He can't take on your armor, and he can't take on a whole platoon. But if you show him an opening, then eventually they're gonna get at you. And so, having headphones on and forgetting about it for a while in the middle of danger is crazy to me. And when Jim Booker was doing what I had described, the bearded guy operations. And he went out there with a pistol and a hand grenade, and that's all he had to defend himself, which would have been almost worthless if he had been attacked.
Right.
And you want to talk about, one of the bravest guys I know, that's Jim Booker. And he said, my God, you don't realize that these people are constantly observing us and watching our patterns and setting up, and they completely own these neighborhoods. And so when we would send sniper teams out, my rule of thumb today is that snipers in those, in an urban environment, are compromised 100% of the time.
Right.
They just because they weren't attacked doesn't mean that some kid or some shopkeeper or somebody didn't observe them going into their hides and reported it.
Right.
It's just the other guy wasn't flexible enough to attack you at that moment.
Right.
And yet we go out there and we it's almost like we're playing at war. And we take chances with people's lives that are just not acceptable. You own up to a higher power, call the moms and dads of those kids that you lead, and you put them in situations where they could be compromised. And I don't take that lightly.
Let me read you an email. Hey, Mac, first of all, love the discussion. And I'm curious. 2-4, that was a fighting deployment. I think I have a couple buddies who were in 2-4. I think they fought the whole time they were there, except maybe the first 45 days, as General Kennedy said a few minutes ago. My question is, his thoughts about post-combat related mental health. General Mattis uses the term post-traumatic growth. I've heard you discuss it here, but the injuries are real. I'm curious his thoughts about about post-traumatic growth, having a father who landed at Normandy, who I'm sure was full of it. Enjoying the program. Thanks for doing these. I love them. Have a great day. Anyway, your thoughts on that whole spectrum.
So thank him for sending that, because we have not seen that bill come presented yet of what the cost of all of those experiences are going to be. These guys are still too soon. And if you figure, if we were there in 2004, we were the first battalion back on after the march up. And then 2-5 and 1-5 and, you know, and the guys that were in Fallujah, the contemporaries in Fallujah. And so all of those veterans groups are now just beyond their 10-year anniversaries. And that's really kind of still in the moment. And so 10 years hence, you're going to have issues that are going to manifest if we don't reach out and touch those dudes. And gals too. You talked about Team Lioness,
right,
and then the FETs that I had over in Afghanistan. You know, they went through trauma as well. And what you find is it's not the ones that are visibly wounded or that have gone through the healthcare system or that are active with veterans affairs. It's the ones that went back to, you know, Idaho or Kansas that are completely off the grid, are not in contact with their peers. And we got to do a better job of finding them, drawing them back into these informal associations. And, you know, social media is the vehicle, and start the dialogue. And I think that they'll find that these are still their comrades. They may be 35 pounds overweight and, you know, all inked up, but they're still Marines, and they're still willing to stand by you in a tough spot. And so if your audience can get energized and start really reaching out to the guys that they haven't heard from in a while, then you'll find out that some of them are pretty bad circumstances, and they need to be helped.
So peer-to-peer.
Peer-to-peer is the best way to do it. You know, I ride motorcycle, and I was down here in Quantico one day, and I saw these guys around Thanksgiving, motorcycle guys down by the museum handing out turkeys. So I went over to them, and they were all Vietnam vets, every single one of them. And they were giving out food donations to Marines, junior Marines, that didn't have a lot of money during the holidays. And so I asked them why they were doing that, and they're saying, look, we don't want to have happen to this generation that happened to ours.
Right.
And so I actually saw, like goodness happening in both directions, where here are these older 50-, 60-year-old gentlemen, because this is a few years ago, making contact with kids that they speak a language that nobody else can speak. No mental health care professional has been through those experiences. But that guy riding that Harley knew exactly what to say to that corporal. And there was healing going in both ways. And so those are peers as well. They don't have to be absolutely the same age group in order to help each other.
Hold on, I just got a text message. Hey, why is he bad-mouthing Idaho? 35 pounds overweight? Inked up? What the fuck? What the fuck? Why can't that guy be in the D.C. area? Why's he got to be in Idaho? I'm in Idaho. I love Idaho. I haven't seen any fat.
He's probably right. My apologies. My apologies to your listening audience. But my point is that they check off the grid.
Right.
I'll tell you what, around D.C., there's lots of organizations that will reach out and help.
Right.
But it's harder when you get away from the coasts.
No, and I'll tell you what. I mean, I've had such an incredible experience just doing this for 10 months. And I have learned so much about the mental health piece of this, about transitioning and moving on with life. Vietnam veterans are incredible stories. I've had Carl Marlanis on, I don't know how many times, talking about his experience. Here's a Rhodes Scholar. He tells the funniest story. Have you met him, Paul?
No.
Need to. He's a Rhodes Scholar, right? And so he winds up in Vietnam. He's a second lieutenant, and they're fighting in the highlands, and they're getting it on with NVA battalions and regiments, going up and down hills. in the jungle, blasting it out with napalm so they can see. I mean, just, and so he said, I've been there for a few weeks, and we're cleaning weapons, my platoon is. One of my Lance Corporal squad leaders, a guy, his nickname is Jake, he said, he comes up to me, and he says, hey, sir, can I ask you a couple questions? He said, now, all the Marines are cleaning weapons. You know, we're kind of in a circle. I'm sitting on an ammo crate or something, cleaning mine. And he says, and I said, yeah. He said, they're all listening. He says, is it true that you went to Yale? And he says, yeah, I went to Yale. And he said, I'm pretty fortunate. I got a scholarship there. I'm from Oregon. He goes, yeah. He goes, that's what we heard. He said, that's what we heard. He said, is it true that you're a Rhodes Scholar? And Marlana says, yeah. And this kid looks at him and says, you got to be the dumbest fucking Rhodes Scholar on the planet. And he said, he started laughing. And I looked at him and he said, yeah, you could probably make the case for that. There's not too many of them here in the grunts. And they laughed and shook their head. But Marlanus tells a story about it. He said, I didn't know what post-traumatic stress was. I didn't know anything about that. He said, you know, and he said, what really haunted me was I probably killed people that I didn't have to kill. He said, I can remember two young Vietnamese soldiers in particular. He said, I was pissed because this Marine that they called Canada, one of the bigger in life men that you have in your organization, that when fighting starts, he's large physically and he's larger as a personality. And he was wounded. He said he was getting an IV and he was getting patched up, and then somebody got hit. And he tore the IV out of his arm, he grabbed his rifle, and he went and he got killed. And when Canada got killed, that kind of went through the platoon, and he said, and we were enraged, and he said, you know, I killed two kids who tried to surrender. He said it was real quick. It was like they dropped their weapon and they started to put their hands up. He said, so I was well within. He said, but I struggle with that. And he said, it took me years to even begin to talk about it and deal with it because I just shut it off like everybody else did. And so
I don't want to get off the mental health part, but you know, one of the lies is that it's hard to take another person's life. And
yeah.
That's crazy. That's right. Easy. And especially when you are emotionally brittle and you've been through those experiences and you've lost a friend like you just described, and like it's payback. It's one, you're desensitized to it. You're in a heightened state of alert, and you're going to get some back. You're going to get payback.
Yeah,
and
everybody wants it. You can feel it. Somebody's going to get killed. We're going to go avenge
right. What
just happened. And I'll tell you what, you tell me, what's it like to say no, say, all right, everybody stop what you're doing.
Yeah, I had a company commander, brave, love the guy, lost some guys to IED strike. Blamed, somebody that probably wasn't guilty, and was, I saw the rage in his eyes, and he was murderous at that point.
Right.
And I said, if you cannot handle this as a leader, I'm going to fire you. I'm going to replace you with somebody that can handle this emotionally. And you could see him come down because this is an incredible guy, but everybody is prey to that.
Right.
Anybody could become that. And so that's what the leaders are supposed to do, is you're supposed to check each other. And you make sure that somebody that has gone through trauma, that you were the backstop and you prevent them from doing that stuff. When I go back to General Zinni again, one of my first regimental commanders, he said that when he took over his company and they were cutting, his predecessor had been cutting ears off, is what he said.
Right.
And that within a day of him taking commands, and he said, we're not going to do that anymore. Just stop that. And I don't know what other actions he took, but somebody came up to him that night and said, sir, we've been waiting for somebody to tell us to stop. And that's what leadership does. They you need a coach. You need somebody to get you past your worst instincts.
Because
they get pretty bad over there.
Well, and you know what? It's just, as you said, about Marlanus, it's, to take life when you have all the guns and you know, it's, and you want to do it. And I remember we had I want to say three Marines get killed, and we're tracking the guys who did it, and we're and I was at the regimental level, and the battalion commander, who's a friend of ours, he was pissed right? I mean, because look, you're out there, you're invested in it, and you come back and you say, how are they? And you know, and I looked at him and said, they're all dead. And you know, with that, you know, you're pissed, right? They're dead. And so he heads over to the hospital to go see, you know, and just make sure everything's good and whatnot. And then he comes back from that, from seeing mangled bodies, right? Because it doesn't happen like in the movies,
right?
It's real, you know, arms and legs and faces and all kinds of stuff. And he comes back, and you know your friends, and his black blood is gushing in his veins. And he said, and he looks and he says at the regimental air officer, he says, where are we with that? And he says, XYZ battalion, they're still working it. And he looks at him and he says, you kill those guys, you got it? And so the air officer's standing like right in front of me. He says, you, and we're kind of maybe 15 or 20 feet away. And he says, he points at him, you kill those guys. If you have to take that away from them and you have to take that shot, you take it. I'm going to hold you personally responsible. And, you know, he's a major, right? And his eyes are big. And I said, just say yes, sir. And, you know, his eyes kind of go to me. And I said, don't look at me. Just say yes, sir. Okay. And he kept going. And he said, you got that. And he said, he looked at him and he said, yes, sir. And then the door slammed and he left. And I looked at him and I said, we're not doing that, okay? They're doing what they're supposed to do. We're doing what we're supposed to do. We'll keep an eye on it. And you know, within 10 minutes, he came back in and he said, hey, I'm, you know, he said, I'm sorry. You know, you know what you're doing. And I just gave him the thumbs up. I said, we're good. And to have professionals around like that, when your blood wants death, it's one of the hardest things leaders do, because it's not the popular thing to do. And
Martin Van Creveld used to say, don't become worse than the thing you're trying to defeat.
Right.
And he predicted it. That was back in the early 90s. He predicted what we would go through during, you know, Iraq and Afghanistan.
I was his escort in Northern Virginia, and I took him down to Camp Lejeune.
Lejeune for everybody that's listening.
It's not. It's Lejeune. Pronounce it Lejeune. So why would you say Lejeune?
That's the way it is.
The Nutmeggers. Era. Boys, we don't. Cuba. Where's the R in Cuba? Oh, it ain't there, is it? Anyway, so we go down to Camp Lejeune, and I'm asking him about, you know, some of the stuff about the Israeli Defense Force in Lebanon. And he looked at me and he said, you can only stick a sword in salt water for so long before it corrodes. And he said, and that's what happened to us. We corroded. We lost our way. And specifically, we were talking about the IDF and what went on in those refugee camps south of Beirut when they had massacres and those things. And supposedly the IDF was a part of it in some way, shape, or form, and talked about it being a stain. Let me read you another email. I spent a lot of time for various reasons at the 5th Marines Memorial over the past year. I routinely bumped into vets coming back to see the names of their buddies from OIF and OEF. A lot of them were 2-4 guys from that 2004 deployment. They're a tight crew. Curious about your comments. I went to the 10-year, I think, anniversary or commemoration. They read a speech that you wrote. You were out in the Pacific. And it is a tight, if somewhat motley, crew these days. Talk about the magnificent bastards that you fought with, and that tightness that seems to stay with that group.
Yeah, it's always had a strong veteran association, all the way from Dido. General Weiss was the battalion commander. And then it's just stayed. And they've supported us, and the Marines that were from the battalion in 2004 have supported. And then they went back a year or two later under Jim Glynn, and they had their own experiences. And so this is a unit that has a habit of maintaining the association and helping each other out. So I was one of our guys, Jonathan Hancock, walked across the country last year. He walked like 5,000 miles, maybe it was more than that, like almost like a Forrest Gump situation. And he visited the families of our fallen and just had this epiphany, I guess, while he was walking. And so I was there at San Mateo because I could not make the 10-year. I wanted to be there this past year. And ran into him and saw a lot of those guys that you're talking about. And it's incredible that these guys are still living that moment, you know, 2017, and they're still talking about what happened 13 years ago. And I hope that they do that for the rest of their lives, because there are some people that are going to manifest issues that have not been touched, that have not thrown into the association. We don't know where they are, and we've got to, you know, really cast that net. I've got all their names still on a spreadsheet, so we're going to tick them off one by one and make sure they're all okay.
In terms of peer-to-peer?
Yeah, peer-to-peer. And here's a case study that we assume victim status of everybody that has been through those experiences. And so I was down in College Station.
Okay, let me stop you. So when you hear the term post-traumatic growth, well, the first time I heard Gerald Mattis say that, I thought, what the hell is he talking about? And if he's saying it, maybe I should investigate it. And one of the points is, hey, you know, the greatest generation came back, and they built the world that we live in. So why do we think that we can come back, claim victim status, and be irrevocably be permanently damaged by it? Why is that? And I thought, and then it kind of like, it was, I almost felt it was like a challenge in terms of, hey, if they can do it, why can't you? And why is there this assumed victim status and this lifelong disability that goes with it? And I just thought it kind of turned the kaleidoscope a little bit for me in terms of the way we view it, maybe self-fulfilling prophecies, and the way we talk about it. I'm curious about your thoughts about that.
So let's not use 2-4. So
okay,
3-5 is up in Sangin, Black Horse Battalion. They take.
Dark Horse Battalion.
Yeah,
Black Horse is the third cab.
Yeah, they have their own miserable experience up there.
Right.
And there were folks that wanted to take them off the line because they had seen. I was told this. They've seen enough. Just take them off the line. And their experience is about what the same sorts of things that happened in Ramadi and Fallujah back, you know, 2004 through 2007, probably.
Right.
I said, and I told the person that was asking that, I said, sir, don't do that. Don't do that. They will never recover if you pull them out as victims. And sure enough, after about 60 days of that sort of abuse, they turned the tables, and they became really lethal towards their enemies. And they have their own association, you know, Veterans Association, and I think because they were not victimized, they were not, you know, brought into a cult of victimization, that they have succeeded themselves. And so Jason Morris was the battalion commander,
right,
and they've actually had a very low incidence of all of those problems that you typically see, like suicides and substance abuse, and they're doing well. I mean, I'm not saying it's universal, but
right,
but they have not had the sorts of problems that you've seen other units have that have been through that abuse. So it can be done if you just decide you're not going to, you know, curl up in a ball. I'm not trying to play that down, but people have got to grow from the horror of what they saw, and it can happen. And so I was going to tell you that I'm down in College Station. The colonel that's down there at Texas A&M says, yeah, I got to meet this guy that runs a bar in College Station. So I go down there, and they're trying to find the owner. And all of the bartenders, all of the wait staff, everybody who's in the kitchen are veterans. And they're all bearded and tatted up, and you know, they look like former Marines and soldiers that have transitioned, and but
right,
they're wearing, like, you know, white aprons and black ties, and
right,
they're really good at what they're doing.
Right.
So the owner comes out, and he's a 2-7 Marine. And 2-7, when they went back to Helmand through 2007-2008, I believe, they got manhandled. It was tough. They were spread out over a place that two regiments basically sat on later on. And this guy says, sir, you know, I'm not going to be a victim. He's a former staff sergeant, and he opened this bar. It's called West End Elixir. There's a free plug. And you got to go and see this place. These guys are all positive. And so they're all enrolled in classes at A&M or in the local colleges. They all got like an azimuth for the rest of their lives. And here's this positive force. And so he said, I'm not going to fall into the, you know, I won't become apathetic, or I won't become feel sorry for myself, that I'm going to be positive. And he hires guys, and he props them up, and they probably sustain each other, and it's a good news story. So that, I would rather see that. I think that's what General Mattis is talking about, post-traumatic growth.
But it's that peer-to-peer, the same thing that we did on active duty, that same kind of leadership, that same kind of reaching out, that same kind of I give a crap. It's that, and let me tell you, and Paul and I haven't talked about this. It's the first discussion we've ever had about these kind of things. That's the exact conclusion I have. Look, the VA is great and all that kind of stuff, and they can provide services, right? But how do you talk to a therapist who hasn't seen what you've seen? Now, maybe they can help you a little bit, but your friends that you've gone through this with, your battle buddies, the guys you serve with, they're way better at this than anybody else will ever be. And so the whole peer-to-peer, the social networking, the reunion thing are all huge, 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 in my opinion, ways that to combat this thing. And then the other part of this is, again, I believe it's kind of a defiant thing. It's like, hey, wait a minute, man. We get one lap around the track before somebody decides that it's time for us to get off the track. We're the lucky ones. We got to come home.
Right.
And I think that the more that we all went back and forth, you know, there's a fair amount of luck in surviving those events. The God, I always say, the God who governs the flight of metal through the air is a fickle human being or God or whatever the hell they are, because it could have hit you, but it doesn't. It could have, you know, and then others that, you know, how does it get through a 50 cal machine gun and two shields and in the front of a teacup and hit somebody just below the helmet line, you know,
right.
The magic piece of shrapnel, if you will. Why does that happen? Well, you know what? Who knows? But the randomness of combat, especially when you go multiple times, I mean, you watch it and you're like, you know what? I'm lucky to be here. But that message can't come from anybody else but a peer, because if anybody else tells you that kind of stuff, you just have, you know, you have a hate, and most of the time you're not receiving it well. And so it's like, hey, man, go away. You don't know. And so to me, your message about peer-to-peer is spot on. I another email for you. Hey, Mac, leadership question for General Kennedy. Small unit leaders, what advice when he speaks to them? And I love, this is in parentheses, and I love the idea of the squad leader portraits on the wall, the message that sends. What advice does he have for small unit leaders when he talks to them about leading?
They need to prepare themselves like they see their leaders prepare, you know, intellectually, read, practice. You've got a team, and you got to do it through repetitions. We used to make fun of battle drill when we were instructors, the last refuge of the unimaginative. I can tell you what, battle drill in the middle of a firefight lets you think. And so when you know your squads or your fire teams are doing something because you've trained them to take immediate action, that buys you some time in which to think through the particulars of that situation. And otherwise you're frozen in the kill zone and everybody's looking to you to make a decision. And so small unit leaders, train yourselves to react immediately. And then they need to habituate themselves when they're out of contact into thinking about it, thinking about the business, about what would you do. And, I mean, that's about as good as I could say. You got to take action. You know, we at the higher echelons, we use analytical decision-making models, and we just mull over courses of action, and it takes a lot of time. Squad leader doesn't have that. It has to be instinctive, and they got to take action. And so decide and act, because your actions are going to precipitate the other side into taking action. And so better to do something to get the ball moving and then make another decision and then another one. And eventually, if you're good enough, the other side can't keep up with you.
Another email. Hey, Mac. First of all, great interview with General Kennedy. Question for him. Did he see Band of Brothers And did it affect the way that he thought about his own father's service? So I think the answer to that would be yes. But did you see it? It's probably, I think when you see it, it's so rich in detail. If you've ever heard the noises of combat, you've seen the sights of combat. If you've ever seen that, wow. Wow, 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 wow. Did it affect the way that you looked at your father's service?
You know, my dad used to tell us a lot of stories from his experiences. And I have seen Band of Brothers, and Stephen Ambrose did a great job of capturing what they went through. There's a heroic vein that runs through that series.
Right.
That when you see the next version called Pacific, you don't see that same thing.
Dark.
Right.
Dark,
and dark. I realize now that there were almost two different experiences, the European theater and the Pacific theater. And it's very, very corrosive, emotion as a person. It's a corrosive environment with what the Army and the Marine Corps went through in the Pacific. And so I see both. I had a Band of Brothers in 2-4, but I also saw the horror of what bodies look like, what people are could be prone to if they're not led correctly. I've got both perspectives.
All right, another email question. Interesting one. Hey Mac, I'd be curious. I've heard you say that the biggest difference between Iraq and Afghanistan, in your opinion, was the proficiency of suicide bombers in Iraq and what that forced on all the units relative to learning escalation of force, that same threat wasn't as significant in Afghanistan. I'm curious what General Kennedy's thoughts are. What was the major difference between the two theaters?
There is, in Afghanistan, there is some measure of restraint on somebody's part. I don't know who to attribute it to.
Okay.
Because we did not see what your person described.
First of all, can you describe it in 30 seconds? What was that like every day in Ramadi, not knowing that whatever white opal that drove past you, next to you, near you, wasn't going to explode, and that every day that you could wind up like that? What was that like to live like that?
That's put you on edge. You wear your teeth down, you know, anticipating. We had rules to try to mitigate that, like don't ever stop where there's two-way traffic, where somebody could actually just park themselves next to a convoy that's waiting to do whatever and blow themselves up. We used to use vehicles. If we didn't have the ability to put up a barrier, put a vehicle up and then back away from it. Get out of the vehicle and back away from it and provide overwatch. And if somebody wants to run at you, they'll hit the Humvee and not hit the Marines. And so General Mattis's rule was, you know, make yourself hard to kill, and we didn't always practice that. And I had one of my platoon commanders, Dan Crawford, and he never took the same route twice. And it would take him twice as long to go from point A to point B as anybody else in the battalion, and he didn't have any casualties. And it wasn't that he wasn't fighting, but he just made himself hard to predict. And so,
wow.
Carry that forward to Afghanistan. Up in Sangin, the 1st Battalion that was there, 3-7, they parked their vehicles, and they walked to work. And they walked through canals and over walls and through cornfields just to make it hard to be killed. If the enemy can't anticipate where you're going to step, he has a hard time putting an IED in your path.
Right.
And so, we forget that, you know. It's you know, it's 90% of just repetition, doing the same thing day in and day out, you know, punctuated by bursts of you know, excitement. So you get lulled into this complacency, and that's what kills people. That's what provides opening, because the other guy's always watching you. So that would be my answer.
All right. A couple of questions for you, and then I'll let you go. First of all, I appreciate taking so much time. I know you we love these conversations, and I don't know that when we were young that we ever expected to have the experiences that we've all had in our lifetime. And I've been really fortunate that I friends like you called me and Dave Furness and Larry Nicholson took me to different places. And what I was blessed with is I only went with my friends. I never joined a unit and reported in and went with strangers. Every, you know, when I went to Afghanistan, you know, Chris Bronzy, I met through you, out at Combat Outpost that day. He and I had become friends because we were fellow IOC instructors and he had me over for dinner. And then when we went back to Afghanistan, you know, to be with him, to be with Dave Furness, and there's this tightness. So a couple questions for you. As a leader in combat, what's the most frustrating thing that you experience?
It's probably having to repeat myself every day for the duration of the deployment. That's the most frustrating thing. That you can prevent a lot of unnecessary harm by enforcing discipline. You know, the rules we had were create an environment of discipline, attention to detail. And I can't stress that enough, that if leaders aren't doing inspections and you see something that needs to be fixed, you take action. Most people just kind of let it go by and you miss, you know, in Afghanistan, we started finding about 80% of the IEDs without any sort of a bomb sniffing dog or a magic wand. They actually saw it because they were looking. And attention to detail is important and enforcement of the standards. So if you abide by those three things, discipline, attention to detail, and standards, you'll get through most of it. And instead of falling off of a cliff, it becomes a manageable slope, glide slope to the finish.
Talk to me about discipline.
Discipline, I don't mean punishment. Okay. I don't mean...
What do you mean?
Mindless, just yes or no, sir, three bags full. But I mean coming back, every time a patrol came back, they would do supervised... a download of their weapons. Then they would clean up their vehicles, clean up their weapons, put all that stuff away before they went to have chow. Then the squad leaders would make sure that the Marines, you know, if they were all trash, they'd get new uniforms on, or clean uniforms at least, that they would make sure they're hydrated. I didn't have any heat casualties.
Is that amazing, though? I mean,
heat stroke. I had guys that had heat exhaustion. Yeah. I had heat exhaustion. But I'm talking about heat stroke, not one. And it's because small unit leaders are making the guys not just drink. It's not really that. It's eating.
Right.
And we would sleep in air-conditioned spaces not because we were soft, but because by the time that they wake up 6 hours later, they can't be all dehydrated from just having slept.
Right.
So that's the kind of discipline that I'm talking about. And you know, General Mattis jacked me up during OIF-1 about shaving. And I've never forgotten that lesson. And shaving is not a cosmetic activity. And it's not even so your gas mask fits. It's so that when the small unit leader is walking down the line and he sees that you've taken care of business, it might be the only time during the day in which you use soap and water to clean yourself up, that I know you've probably also eaten, you've cleaned your weapon, and you're ready to go. Just shaving. That's the lesson he imparted. And that you shave every day because it's a visible sign that you're in it. Get your head in the game. So I outlawed electric razors. You know, that's a drill in cosmetics. Take a minute out, get the water out, and if you're not already, you know, you're in the middle of a patrol base and you got to decide whether you're going to eat, you know, you got limited food or water, take care of your hygiene. That's discipline.
The interesting email here. Hey, Mac, I'm listening. And was General Kennedy part of a debate about socks, or am I thinking of somebody else that I remember going on in the Gazette? Was he a part of that? Was it when he was a regimental commander, or am I mistaken?
No, I was not part of that, but I understand. You know, there's a famous article written about white socks and why we do or don't wear them, and it had nothing to do with the fact they were white socks. It had to do with it was a variation from the uniform, directed uniform. And what we found both in Iraq and Afghanistan is that when everybody gets to tailor their uniform, and I understand the whole concept of, you know, that's your fighting space and it ought to be efficient and, you know, you want to set it up, it flies in the face of a lot of veterans that have said, the only reason I knew that was the Marine was the way he carried his uniform. That's the way we did it in our unit. Zinni would talk about, you know, about uniformity and that it saves people's lives in a split second. When you see somebody, you have to recognize them as a friend or a foe. I mean, that's kind of what the debate was about, not about White Sox.
The discipline of combat.
Yeah, like if that's the prescribed uniform, wear it. And if you got a way, if that unit wears their gear a certain way, a lot of times, you know, at night, guy's down, you want to know where his ammo is, you want to know where his medical kit is. If you got to search for it and it's in a, everybody's unique, that makes you inefficient. That was the whole point. And those lessons were learned 100 years ago, and we're having to relearn them today.
Another question for you, and then I'll let you go. Hey Mac, I'm curious about the mental health piece of this as well. General Kennedy talked about his guys and the peer-to-peer program. Does he have a message for people that are interested in starting networks about what works better? Do you have a best practice relative to peer-to-peer stuff?
Yeah, it's great that they do grassroots versions.
Right.
And it's dialed in. It's tailored to the needs of the folks that are associated with it. A lot of times it's resource constrained, and so I would say you start that way and then try to become taken under the fold of a larger organization. And I would tell you all the former battalion commanders and battalion sergeant majors will be those leaders till the day they die. And so I would try to get battalion-level associations. In the Marine Corps, we have the Semper Fi Fund. It's a great place for people to touch base, and then they can figure out, you know, what their veterans' benefits are and who they can contact, and they can put you in touch with similar organizations that will do that peer-to-peer sort of bolstering of morale.
All right.
It's out there. They've been doing God's work since basically we've been involved in this conflict, and it was started by family members, right. And it continues, and it's a very low overhead organization, and almost all of their money goes back to the thing that they say that they do, which is help Marines. And Matt, can I one more thing? I was just at a wedding, and a guy comes up to me, and he was obviously a veteran. Army tanker from Ramadi in about 2007. And he did not have anybody that was helping him through life. Had been in the Army in a long time and was in a part of Texas, was somewhat removed, was successful, but it doesn't mean that he doesn't need somebody to talk to.
Right.
And if it isn't somebody from his unit, it needs to be somebody. And it could be a soldier to Marine, soldier, sailor, whatever, but these veterans need to throw in now, develop the habits while they're young, so, you know, we don't have problems when they're older.
You know, interesting, I was going to see my therapist, and I was really lucky when I went to the VA. I met, just by guys when I walked through the door, two different guys. Both were Vietnam infantry special forces guy, and they were awesome. And so when guys talk about their bad experiences at the VA, I only had great ones, but I was really fortunate. And then I talked to another veteran. When I walked into their offices and I saw their I Love Me stuff, it was like, I've seen this. This is my tribe. These are my people. They were great guys, but not everybody has that experience. And so to me, you meet guys that have done exactly what we've told them to, which is go to the VA, right?
Right.
And then they turn away from it and they're alone. And so anyway, one day, when I got to the West LA, place where I went to, and I walk in and they just finished this Vietnam, veteran group thing. And so I'm talking to my guy and I said, hey, what do you talk to those guys about so many years later? And he looked at me and he says, the same thing I talked to you about. I said, after all these years, He said they never dealt with it.
Right.
He said, you know, they came back from Vietnam. They stuffed it. They stuffed it in the Jack in the Box. And they didn't go near the hand crank. Because there was nobody that wanted to talk to them about it. And now, after they've retired, it's coming out of the wood. All the things that they haven't thought about. Now they have time on their hands, and now they think about it. And they've never dealt with it. They've never put it in perspective. They've never talked about it. And that's what I'm doing with them. And I said, after all these years, and he said, it's not going away. It's not going away.
Yeah, that's a crime.
Right. I mean, you think about that, and it's like, wow. And so, no, the I think the peer-to-peer thing is great advice in terms of starting a network and then migrating it to whether it be, you know, the three, four alumni association or whatever, that you migrate it towards a larger organization and do that way. But it certainly is. All right. This is kind of the general article at the end. What haven't I asked you about leadership that you want to throw out there to make sure people know?
I think I've beaten this thing flat, but I would tell you that there's no other walk alive in which one American gets to tell another American to risk his life, his or her life. And so for all the aspiring leaders and officer candidates and whoever else is out there, that you got to take this thing seriously, and that kid, that private, actually has their own support network, and they're hoping that you are professional enough to get their son or daughter back to them at the end of that ordeal. And if you don't take that seriously, just don't play. Just don't come. We don't need you. And I can't stress that enough. And we go about this thing as though we're moving pawns around on a chessboard or something. And these are real people. And we'd like to see them as veterans. So there you go.
All right. What's up next for the Marine Corps Recruiting Command?
Winning. Winning.
What is, hey, are we not the few and the proud anymore? Are you in charge of that? Did you do that?
We are few and proud. Look at the commercials.
Oh, okay. All right. Just
yeah, that's all, again, rumor. Lots of rumor. Lots of people, lots of opinions. The commercial hasn't changed.
You know what? I'll tell you what. I'm a big fan of the commercial where it shows the guy taking that guy down in that convenience store.
Yeah, that's a real thing. I won't talk any more about that, but it's a real deal.
No, one of the cool things about All Marine Radio and telling the stories of the culture of the Marine Corps is that, you know, Marines are on active duty for a relatively short period of time.
Right.
As Darius Maximus says, what they do in life echoes through eternity. And so that Marine Corps experience echoes through their life forever. And what they do outside of the Marine Corps, I mean, is incredible. From walking across the United States to creating companies to creating FedEx, all the different ways that the Marine Corps experiences touches lives and changes lives on a daily basis around the country is, and you know this as Darrell Officer, as much as you get around the Marine Corps, is absolutely amazing.
Yeah, for life.
For life.
Yeah, even if they reject it, you know, for some period of their life, they come back around to it. It's for life.
All right. Major General Paul Kennedy. All right, buddy. Thank you very much.
Yep. Bye.
There you have it. Leadership on a Tuesday morning. Interesting conversation. Now, you know what? It's interesting. The things that he talks about are things that we've spoken about for years. And I remember talking with him because he and I got to be friends teaching squad tactics, which we'd love to do. And then we started doing decision-making stuff, and the burning bush through all of that was General Zinni. And we'd listen to him, and we'd quote him, and we'd call him. And it's interesting that Paul, even in light of his experiences, you hear him caveat the things that he says by referring to General Zinni's comments about, hey, you know, I'm sometimes reluctant to share my experiences because – you know, I see a lesson there, and maybe not that wasn't really the way it happened. You know, I see a cause and effect thing that was maybe more coincidence. So it's interesting, but he's a smart guy. And it's good to know that we're still a few of the proud, the Marine. So we're going to take a break, and hopefully the Gunner will be able to join us next. But I've been wanting to do that for a long time. Like I said, I have great friends. That interview that I've done with guys like Dave Furness, John Kelly, John Allen, you can bring those guys on. You can ask them anything. And when you hear General Kennedy talking about, you know, having to restrain people from killing because killing's easy, those are leadership challenges. Those are leadership challenges. Leadership challenge in a firefight to grab the headset and talk to Chris Bronzy and start making fun of him, asking him if he's hiding under his Humvee. Hey, Bronzy, are you hiding under your Humvee? What are you doing? What? No, I'm not. You know, all in an effort to do what? To lead, right? To dial it down. It's going to be okay. Hey, if he's making jokes, if he's busting my balls, then guess what? It's going to be okay. And so that sense, it's not easy stuff to do. And so anyway, happy to be able to, you know, share that with everybody today. We're going to take a quick break. More of All Marine Radio coming up next on a Tuesday. And this hour of All Marine Radio and that interview brought to you by our friends at Battle Mug, home of the one and only Battle Mug that starts out as a 10-pound block of aluminum. And they'll mill it, machine it, and anodize it, and then they'll put a serial number on it. From there, you make it yours. Picatinny rails on the side. Whatever goes on your rifle can go on your mug. If you're out and about hunting, got it in the vehicle, you can use it. You can take it up in your stand. All those products sitting right there on your mug. So exciting stuff. Each mug capable of anything that goes on your weapon goes on your mug. And then if you have it in your office, you can go ahead and throw unit insignias, flags, service emblems, things like that. Make it very cool. Breaking news. The nation's been following this Facebook murder suspect, Steve Stevens. Washington Post is reporting, the police are reporting that he is dead. So more of that. Anyway, you can check out the entire line of Battle Mug products at battlemug.com. And again, they're great for any type of commemorative event, farewells, promotions, retirements, anniversaries, birthdays, all that stuff works. You can get 15% off if you use promo code Marine on the website. Battle Mug is a veteran-owned and operated company made entirely in the United States. More of All Marine Radio on a Tuesday coming up next right here on the All Warrior Radio Network.
MilitaryByOwner.com is an excellent resource for any military family moving to a new area. We found a ton of homes to choose from and purchased a house 8 days later. This was the only site I used. Thanks, Military by Owner.
Are you PCSing? Do you need to find a home near a military base quickly? With over 45,000 listings and 15 years of experience helping military families find, sell, or rent their home near a military base, MilitaryByOwner.com can help. Military by Owner. Proven and dependable.
My name is Juan Perez, Jr. I joined the military in 98. I commissioned as an officer. But I always had in mind the idea that I would go into the special operations community, particularly the special forces. I was accepted to go into selection, and I attended on September 8th of 2001. As I was making my departure of the military, there was that uncertainty. What do I do next? How do I repurpose my skills in a way that's not only meaningful to me, but also that provides for my family and provides an increase in our a way of living, a quality of life. The Global South Foundation has resources when it comes to anything from building resumes to how to relate to a CEO in conversation, how to basically, again, repurpose that which I had learned in a career in special operations, dealing at the strategic and operational level. How do I take that and then turn it towards entrepreneurial spirit into business development? And how do I translate that so somebody can see that value? And in doing so, I landed a magnificent and very rewarding career. I'm the VP of operations for an IT company called BuildSource. What I say to veterans getting out, be bold. Be bold when you go to network. Go out to the Global South website. Look at what events they have lined up. Attend those events, you know, and participate. A lot of the events they hold, they're of key importance in this network. Go out there and engage, just like you would engage in a combat zone, you know, when you're networking there. With folks.